Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome to my show here on Blog Talk Radio. This is Joe Hackman. And tonight we're going to be discussing some science. And we actually have a guest tonight that is going to help us understand some of the birth order nuances, some of what drives personalities into particular niches. You may see a lot of diverse personalities in your family amongst the siblings. And my guest is the gentleman who can really help us understand why. He's written several books on family dynamics, birth order, and everything that my guest does is grounded in science. And he tends to study something for a very long time, is very high attention to detail. So I think he's an extremely credible expert on the subject. And I want to welcome my guest, Dr. Frank Soloway. Welcome, Frank.
Thank you very much, Joe.
You're very welcome. So, Dr. Soloway, tell me a little bit about how you got involved with or when the light bulb went off that you wanted to study this particular topic.
Well, very early in my career, I was interested in the life of Charles Darwin and particularly his famous five-year voyage around the world. And I determined from a re-examination of his notebooks and specimens and so forth that he had not been an evolutionist during the Beagle Voyage. That transition from creationist to evolutionist came after his return to England. And that was a sort of a discovery of sorts in the history of science at the time. But what really puzzled me was the fact that all of the evidence that was so impressive to Darwin, Darwin's famous finches from the Galapagos Islands, the mockingbirds, which are separate species on different islands. This evidence, it's not as if Darwin sort of locked it all up for 20 years and then published it in The Origin of Species in 1859. This evidence was actually publicly displayed at the London Zoological Society in 1837, 20 years before The Origin was published, and not one person who attended those meetings was converted to evolution by seeing the very evidence that played such a fundamental role in The Origin of Species. I thought, wow, that's strange. It can't be just evidence that makes somebody a revolutionary scientist. There's got to be something more to it. And the most obvious thing for a theory like evolution in the early 19th century was the heretical nature of the theory. So I concluded that a key factor had to be some aspect of personality that made somebody inclined to support a really unpopular, unconventional viewpoint. And that got me interested in personality psychology, and eventually I stumbled on birth order and got interested in that and found that younger siblings were much more likely to become evolutionists than firstborns. And so I began studying family dynamics more broadly and began looking at the role of birth order in people who either supported or opposed major revolutions in science. So that's how it all got started. That was 26 years before I finally published my book, Born to Rebel.
Wow. So what were some of the more surprise on this journey, I guess, were there a few highlights, a few things that when you learned about it, you just thought, wow, that, you know, it doesn't make sense. It took a little while for it to the data points to convince you. Was there anything like that along the way, or were things pretty logical and reasonable?
Well, there certainly were some interesting puzzles that I encountered along the way. One of the most important arguments that I make in Born to Rebel is that the historical context plays a huge role in the direction of the kinds of effects that you find, in other words, the way in which personality and family dynamics expresses itself. So, for example, there's no such thing as sort of a scientific revolution or the scientific revolution. There are all sorts of different types. There are highly technical revolutions. There are very ideologically driven revolutions. Some of those are go in a liberal direction, and there are actually scientific revolutions that have supported conservative ideologies. A good example of that is the theory of germ theory, which was promulgated by, among other people, by Pasteur. And germ theory was basically a conservative theory because the alternative to it was the theory of spontaneous generation, that, that things can arise, life can arise out of matter by a natural process. And that was viewed as a very materialistic theory. So conservatives tended to like the theory, the germ theory, and radicals tended to like the theory that actually got ousted, namely spontaneous generation. So it turns out when you're trying to understand the role of things like birth order or social class or political and religious views and how they help you predict what somebody will do, you, the first thing you have to do is figure out what kind of revolution is it, because the direction of the effects will change. So in the Darwinian revolution, younger siblings were more likely to support, and so were social liberals, religious liberals, young people, and another series of predictors. Another one was conflict with a parent. But if you go to a very conservative event, almost all those predictors flip-flop in the other direction. So the revolution will be supported by elder siblings, older people, social and religious conservatives. That was quite, an important discovery. It wasn't something I thought about ahead of time and was prepared for.
That's very interesting. You know, I think one of the things that's kind of interesting that sort of the initial inspiration came from Darwin's work, because as I understand it, you've spent a lot of time on the Galapagos, and you have, in fact, I was reading one of your articles today, Why Siblings Are Like Darwin's Finches, and maybe we can talk a little bit about that. How has the actual, your trips to the Galapagos inspired some of your research and provided you with, I know there's a tie-in with one particular theory, and maybe we can enlighten the audience on that particular aspect of it.
Well, my various visits to the Galapagos, and so far there have been 13 over the last 40 years, have played a very significant role in all of my academic work. I first went to the Galapagos as a college undergraduate in order to make a series of films about Darwin and the Beagle Voyage, and I was so enchanted with the Galapagos that I went back a year and a half later as a had a traveling fellowship from Harvard University for a year. And my interests were always, they span not only the history of science, where I sort of started out, but also evolutionary biology. And so I was fascinated by the way in which the Galapagos had impacted on Darwin's life, but also the role they've played in evolutionary theory. And that ended up making a very substantial contribution to my understanding later on, when I got interested in birth order, and just how birth order and family dynamics play themselves out in the family. Basically, siblings are a lot like species, and they end up generally occupying different niches in the family. Now, in evolutionary biology, this is a principle that's actually called Darwin's principle of divergence. Darwin realized that species that all try to compete for the same resource aren't going to do themselves any favors. They're fighting over the exact same thing. And so natural selection will tend to cause species to diversify so that they do not compete directly for the same resources. And siblings in the family do the same thing. So I was able, in a sense, to apply a kind of Darwinian perspective on animal behavior to and on evolution in general to the way I viewed family dynamics, and that stood me in good stead, I think. So Darwin comes in and out of my book, Born to Rebel, in lots of different ways, both as a leader of a revolution and as a promulgator of a theory that plays some role in the understanding of human behavior.
Very interesting. You know, I think sort of to this point, to take it a little step farther in your research, I had mentioned that I like the fact that you gather a lot of data. You study something for a really long time often before you write. I think you spent something like 20 years or maybe longer before you published your first book. But basically all that research went into that book, and you had done some analysis of some other research that had been done and also determined that the majority of it really didn't really wasn't very good quality. Is that still the case today? This was an older interview that I was that I pulled that from.
Well, yeah. I mean, you've touched on something that's quite true, I guess, about my academic and intellectual style. As a college undergraduate, I was a long distance runner, and I really have a kind of a long distance runner's mentality. I look upon a lot of what I do as sort of like running a marathon. So I actually spent 26 years researching and writing Born to Rebel. I wrote a book on Freud. I spent 7 years on that book. I tend to really think about something before I finally sit down and put pen to paper, so to speak. And with the case of the research on birth order and family dynamics, there was a huge amount of research that had been done on that topic prior to my own getting involved in it. But it tended to be somewhat disparate. It would be a lot of separate studies. You know, does birth order affect intelligence? Does birth order affect personality? What traits? It was hard to sort of get an overview to put it all together. It was sort of trait by trait analysis. And one of the things that I tried to do in my book was to provide a broader framework in which we could, in a sense, classify this rather vast literature of several thousand publications and have a kind of useful heuristic or way of summarizing it. And I did that in terms of what are known as the Big Five personality dimensions. It turns out if you analyze every personality test on Earth in every possible language, they're basically only telling you five rather general things about personality. And these Big Five dimensions have come to be known as conscientiousness, agreeableness, extroversion, openness to experience, and neuroticism. And one of the things I tried to do in my book was to align all of the research findings on birth order under those five domains, and then ask what is the function of each of those five domains in terms of a broader theory. So let's take an example. Firstborns tend to be more conscientious than younger siblings. Well, why is that? Well, in terms of family dynamics, firstborns have a rather unique role in the family. They generally occupy a niche as a surrogate parent. And as the eldest, the sort of responsible one, the one who does the babysitting for the other siblings, that tends to sort of open up an opportunity for firstborns to act more adult-like. And they get a lot of brownie points for doing that. So we can sort of we can take each of these Big Five dimensions and ask, how does it play itself out in terms of diversification and family niches within a family context in which siblings are basically competing with one another for what biologists call parental investment. And this is a theory that's been used to explain all sorts of animal behavior, and it works perfectly well for humans, and we call that competition sibling rivalry. So that was a somewhat unique feature of my book, the attempt to bring together a huge, rather disparate literature under an evolutionary psychology rubric that owed itself to a kind of Darwinian perspective on the family.
That's very interesting. Now, I think another kind of there was some interesting places where you were able to find a lot of data points to do research. I love the where you had taken the baseball statistics in order to you assume certain things, and you said, okay, well, I think these people are going to be more prone to this, and I think these people are going to be more prone to do this, and you know, talk a little bit about that, because I think that was some fascinating stuff, and it just kind of gives I think it gives a whole other look to science when you're looking at baseball statistics of all things.
Yeah, this is a study I did with Richie Zweigenhaft, a psychologist at Guilford College, and actually I owe it to Richie. He has a considerable interest in baseball, and we began collaborating on this particular study. And one of the basic questions we asked is, are younger siblings more likely to engage in dangerous sports? There's a very specific reason to ask this question. Younger siblings around the world do get less parental investment than older siblings. And in a Darwinian world, when you get less parental investment and your chances of actually surviving childhood are lower, and they are for younger siblings all across the world, it actually, the cost of risk-taking is lower. After all, if you're not going to survive childhood at all, the cost of risk-taking is zero because you're just not going to make it. So so we looked at a rather substantial literature on birth order in dangerous sports, and a lot of these studies are small, so sometimes just by statistical chance they don't show an effect. So we pooled them together by a technique that's called meta-analysis and found that indeed younger siblings were 50% more likely to engage in dangerous sports like football, rugby, bungee jumping, parachute jumping, and so forth. And then we decided to take a look at Major League Baseball. And the reason for this is in part because baseball aficionados have been keeping statistics for over a century. And so you can get the most incredible amount of data. We decided to look at all of the players who had a brother who played in Major League Baseball. Turns out there are 700 sort of pairs of brothers in Major League Baseball, or groups of brothers, like Joe DiMaggio and Dom and Vin, his siblings. And we then asked the question, what's the one really dangerous thing you can do in baseball? Well, it's base stealing. And it's dangerous for two reasons. One is it has a very high injury rate, just about the highest injury rate you can get in baseball, because you almost always slide into base. And so there's a lot of sprained and broken fingers, sprained and broken ankles, and even, you know, collisions where the guy guarding the base wants to make it difficult for you to actually get to the bag, so he sticks his body in the way. So there's a fair number of injuries. It also turns out that base stealing is quite risky because the marginal benefit of base stealing is very low. Most attempts at base stealing don't do your team any good at all unless you're really good at it. And that's why coaches generally don't encourage base stealing until, you know, the very end of the game when they're down and they've got nothing to lose, so to speak. So we were able to examine all these old base stealing statistics, and we found quite interestingly that the younger siblings in these pairs were significantly more likely to attempt to steal bases than their own elder siblings. And the nice thing about having players who all grew up in the same family is there's no contamination by differences in social class from the families. They're all controlled for the same social background. So it's a pure sort of birth order effect that's going on there. And we also found that the younger siblings were way more likely to attempt to steal bases. They were also more likely to be caught at it. But the net result was they were better at it. It was sort of like practice makes perfect. So it was an interesting little sort of foray into American baseball history.
Yeah, I mean that's really fascinating, and that's I think as a direction for a study, I think being able to have that kind of data is, the whole thing is really fascinating. How that all came together. Now, where does that? So let's carry that over into, I mean, yeah, sports, yeah, baseball, okay. But what about other things? Let's talk about some personalities. Let's talk about some world events that might be on people's mind. Some people that have been big risk takers. Stuff that sort of occurred due to the family dynamics and the birth order. You think of some good examples?
You'll have to suggest an event for me to comment on.
You know, I like the one I like. I do like the president's one is kind of interesting.
Well, we do know that there's a moderate overrepresentation of firstborns as American presidents. It's a pretty small sample. There've only been 45 or so presidents. But it is a significant trend, and that's a reflection of a trend we see more broadly in almost every index of success, intellectual success. Firstborns are more likely to be listed in Who's Who. They're more likely to be to appear in encyclopedias. They tend to be more eminent in fields like science. They're more likely to end up as CEOs of corporations. All of that is probably best understandable in terms of two underlying effects. The first is that because firstborns are more conscientious, they do their homework and they tend to, you know, get into Harvard, Yale, and Princeton when they apply to college. Secondly, elder siblings, firstborns, have slightly higher IQs. It's a small difference. The firstborn typically has one or two, maybe three IQ points more than the secondborn in the family. But if you're applying to college and they have some cutoff rule based on SAT scores, that's going to create a bias in which firstborns are more likely to get into the better colleges. So, you know, three IQ points, that translates into, you know, about 20 or 30 SAT points, and some colleges will cut you off at that point just because you don't have that 20 or 30 SAT points. So, as, you know, it's probably a sort of a silly rule, but they use it. So we tend to see this pattern that we see among American presidents just about everywhere. On the other hand, their, you know, birth order affects other aspects of personality. So younger siblings are overrepresented in other domains of excellence that are somewhat you know, different from being American presidents or CEOs, for example. They were more likely in history to be the great explorers, the sort of Magellans and Christopher Columbuses of the world. I did a survey. I had about 4,000 scientists in my book Born to Rebel, who I studied over a four-century period. And younger siblings were three or four times more likely than elder siblings to circumnavigate the globe, as Darwin did, or to travel to very faraway places, and often risky places to go to, as somebody like Alfred Russel Wallace did, Darwin's co-discoverer of natural selection. So, you know, younger siblings, it's not that firstborns are more necessarily more successful than younger siblings. They're just successful at somewhat different things. And, for example, I don't believe that firstborns or laterborns differ in creativity, in overall creativity, but I think they're creative in different ways.
How so?
Well, firstborns are creative sort of within the system. As an example of that, firstborns win more Nobel Prizes in science than younger siblings do. And, you know, nobody would say that you don't get a Nobel Prize for creativity. Sure you do. But it's not the kind of creativity that upsets the Pope. When Darwin, you know, fomented the Darwinian Revolution, that's the kind of thing that the Pope doesn't like. Copernicus came up with the theory that the Earth isn't the center of the universe. Radical ideological revolutions, involve a different kind of creativity. They involve a willingness to be branded as a heretic, and, you know, poor Darwin went through about 20 years before he published The Origin just worrying about what would happen to his reputation when he finally published that book. He confessed to his closest friend, Joseph Hooker, in 1844. He said, it's like confessing a murder to admit you're an evolutionist, because that implied you were a godless person. And so radical revolutions are a whole different class of whole different kettle of fish than your typical, say, Einstein's theory of relativity, which is so esoteric the average person can't even understand it. So, you know, the Pope's not upset because he doesn't even know what it's all about. But evolution, that was a whole other matter.
Interesting. Yeah, so another concept that you sort of discuss or talk about in some of your works is the sort of these niches that the various siblings find themselves in or that they take onto. And you alluded to it a little bit with the risk-taking on the younger side. But there's a lot of interesting stuff to that besides, you know, being more likely to be a revolutionary. There's some, you know, there's some humor. There's some other things. Let's sort of expand a little bit on those niches and why some of those niches exist.
Well, one of the broad dimensions of personality that come under these big five domains is called openness to experience. I tend to view openness in part as a dimension by which younger siblings find their niche in the family. After all, the firstborn arrives and he or she has that niche nailed down as the surrogate parent, parental helper, responsible one, the babysitter, and so forth. And you get a lot of brownie points for that. The younger siblings sort of looking around, well, what can I do to get, you know, parents to invest more in me? And one of the things I think younger siblings do is they tend to take more risks trying things out experimentally. You don't know whether you're going to be capable of winning a gold medal in figure skating unless you put on those figure skates and try a few of those triple toe loops and fall down a lot. So you have to be willing to experiment. In some ways, you can look upon this aspect of family dynamics as a little like the Monopoly game. The firstborn gets there first, and they've had a little bit of time, accumulated a little bit of a bankroll. And so what do? They buy Boardwalk and Park Place and start putting hotels on it. And then the younger siblings are trying to get around the board to pass go and collect their $200, and they run the risk of landing on Boardwalk and Park Place and getting thrown out of the game. So they're looking for something to invest in a sense, in themselves, that will get parents to reevaluate the property on the board, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the major reasons, I think, why younger siblings do things like participate in dangerous sports. It's not like they crave being in dangerous sports for the hell of it. It's that it's part of a broader risk-taking strategy to try things out that the elder sibling didn't try. And, you know, who in their right mind wants to go, I don't know, bungee jumping if you don't have to? Or, you know, play rugby if you don't have to? What, you know, play tennis or swimming or do this sort of more standard thing. So the younger siblings are sort of exploiting all of the potential niches that the elder sibling didn't exploit. And that generally requires or involves getting into things that are maybe a little less pleasant. That's why they're not so obviously exploited by the older members of the family.
You know, it's fascinating. One of the things that's really kind of funny is as I listened to you speak the first time when you came to to my club and spoke to my group, was just applying what you were saying to my family and thinking about it and going, well, you know, okay. Yeah, you know, I rode, my older brothers played football, but I rode dirt bikes and did crazy tricks on my skateboard. I was way more way more of a risk taker.
Yeah, it sounds like fits the bill.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff, and it is kind of fun to do that. But speaking of history, who are some of, you know, obviously Darwin was one of yours. I'm assuming because he must have been a younger sibling.
Yes, Darwin was the fifth of six children.
Oh, okay.
And most of his supporters were also younger siblings. Typically, they were more likely to be, you know, pretty high up in birth rank. So last-borns from large families or close to last like Darwin was.
Okay. I'm trying to think of some other. Who are some of your favorite besides Darwin, who are some of your favorite scientists and figures, and where do they stand in the? I'm assuming if you enjoy their work, that you probably have found out what they are, and how does that fit?
Well, I included in my book Born to Rebel chapters on political revolutions and religious revolutions. I was quite interested in the Protestant Reformation. The Protestant Reformation was a radical revolution. It was a break with, you know, the authority system and the church, the Catholic Church in Rome. And I did a pretty elaborate analysis of about 700 or 800 major participants in that reform movement or radical revolution, really. And one thing you can do with that kind of data is there was no single reformation. There was what they call the magisterial reformation, of which Martin Luther was a part, which was a sort of a moderate reform movement. And then there was the truly what they call the radical reformation, led by Anabaptists and other real radical zealots, eventually people like Quakers and so forth, who were doing things that were considered very seditious. For example, if you eschewed violence, that was very heretical because it meant you wouldn't enlist in the armed forces and support your ruler. That was no good back in the in the, you know, 16th century. So a lot of the ideas that were floating around in the radical Reformation were real political hot potatoes. And the more radical the participant was, the more likely they were to be a younger sibling. Luther, for example, was an elder sibling, firstborn. But he wasn't a particularly, you know, a radical reformer. So there were a fair number of that group of magisterial reformers is part firstborn, part laterborn. The opponents of the Reformation are highly firstborn, and then the real radical reformers tend to be mostly younger siblings. So that was an interesting event to look at. I was also very interested in looking at the French Revolution, and that's a very unusual event historically. It started out as a typical younger sibling-led, you know, protest against ossified authority in the early years of the Revolution. And then as the Revolution got more more violent, there was an election to what was called the National Convention. About 890 people were elected, including figures like Robespierre. And in that convention, the deputies basically went to war with each other, and there were actually 15 deputies who were siblings of each other, and none of them sat in the same parts of the convention. They were all polarized, just like the other members of the convention were. And the younger siblings who had sort of led the revolution then became more marginalized, and it was the liberals, all the members of the National Convention were liberal, but the firstborn liberals in the convention sort of took over power. They began to run the show. And that is not totally paradoxical because firstborns tend to be sort of leader types. And eventually, it was the firstborns in the National Convention who sponsored the Reign of Terror. The younger siblings were the sort of moderates. So it's an irony here where you normally think of younger siblings as being the radicals, therefore they should never be moderates. But in fact, in the context of that particular event, they began to resist the excesses of the revolution, which were getting very, very nasty. And so in that sense, they did something that was, in its context, very unconventional, very very risk-oriented. Some of them, like Danton, who led the early years of the French Revolution, were executed for not being hard-nosed enough. You know, it got to a point where in the National Convention, you were either with us or you're either with the extremes of Robespierre and the Committee of Public Safety and the Reign of Terror, or you're not, in which case you got arrested and executed. So it was a very interesting event to watch the deputies essentially go after each other, and it became a fraternal war within the National Convention. And such an irony, because one of the leitmotifs of the French Revolution was liberté, fraternité, and I forgot what the third one was. But they viewed themselves as brothers, and yet they got involved in sibling rivalry within the National Convention and ended up executing each other. So one of the interesting things about that whole event was the 893 deputies to the National Convention are all in an encyclopedia, and we know exactly how they voted on six or seven major issues. So you could actually construct a computer model of the entire voting of the convention and test hypotheses about how sibling dynamics played itself out in the French Revolution. Just a marvelous thing to be able to do.
Now, is that something that you did as a part of your research?
Yes, that's actually one of the chapters in Born to Rebel. And it's actually my favorite chapter, I think, just because it was such an unusual thing to be able to literally have that kind of data. It's a little like the American baseball data. Without all those hardworking guys collecting all those base stealing statistics for a century, you couldn't do the study that Richie Zweigenhaft and I did. But the data are there, and you can do it. It's the same with, there was a guy named August Kuczynski, a Polish historian who spent his entire life researching the lives of the 893 deputies in the National Convention during the French Revolution. And he wrote a sort of an encyclopedia with every single deputy having an article in that volume. And so you can look up, you can find out what their birth orders were, what their social class was, what their previous political experience was, and most critically, how they voted on these key issues. So you can then test whether the voting patterns were influenced by birth order, and they were.
Wow. How about our founding fathers?
I haven't done a really scientific survey of the American Revolution. It's not, you know, by world revolution standards, it's not a radical revolution.
Okay.
It's a break from authority, yes. But in the eyes of the revolutionaries, it was a very justified break from authority. After all, we were being taxed here, and we weren't given the rights under British law to have the kind of, the voting rights that you'd expect if you're paying equal taxes. So it was an unjust situation. And when you have revolutions that are fomented by a justified cause, well, that's not a particularly radical event. Conservatives will join those kinds of events. Radical events are really unpopular events. So they're more like, what a Che Guevara was doing, or, deciding you're just at war with the entire world.
Gotcha. So what type of, you're at Cal, correct, at Berkeley?
Yes.
And what kind of, are you teaching there? Are you doing research? What are you at liberty?
I primarily do research, although I occasionally teach a course in evolutionary psychology. Begins with Darwin and goes right up to the present day in terms of what we know about how evolutionary theory helps us to understand human behavior.
Okay. And what types of, what are you working on these days? What's your latest project, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, for the last 7 or 8 years or so, I've been doing a lot of research in the Galapagos Islands of a biological nature, in particular research on Darwin's famous finches and evolutionary patterns among the finches. I have a project in the Galapagos where I'm studying ecological degradation due to the introduction of invasive species. This is actually a topic Darwin was very interested in. If you go back and read The Origin of Species, one of Darwin's most powerful arguments for creationist theory being wrong was the case of oceanic islands and the fact that they are very susceptible to invasion by forms from the continent. So Darwin's argument was, look, if God was totally omnipotent and put things on in every place that was perfectly designed for that place, then oceanic islands would be completely impervious to invasion because the perfect species would be there, and anything else that tried to get in there would be less perfect and it would go extinct. But that's exactly the opposite of what you see. The fact is that oceanic islands have been founded by stragglers that somehow managed to get there through, rafting or blowing out on a wind current. And we know from evolutionary studies that the events that have colonized oceanic islands occur extremely rarely. For Hawaii, it was something like once every 250,000 years. For the Galapagos, it's probably once every 30,000 years. Some seed gets out there, some bird species gets out there. And these things arrive there, there's like nothing there. There's no competition. It's like an empty environment. And so there's not a lot of pressure to necessarily sort of evolve to perfection, so to speak. And so the kind of intense competition that we see in, life in the tropics in Brazil or whatever, that's a whole different ballgame than what you see on an impoverished oceanic island. Well, so things in Darwinian theory, things only need to evolve to be as good as they need to be to just survive there, and that's what happens. But if you introduce something from the outside, it may have some unusual advantage, and then things on oceanic islands have no sort of no defense. So I'm interested in that whole topic. Darwin spent a lot of time in The Origin of Species documenting cases like that. He didn't have data on the Galapagos because it had been colonized too recently, but he drew on the case of New Zealand, St. Helena, Ascension Island, anything he could find that showed this principle that oceanic islands are very vulnerable to invasion. And he actually heard at one point that somebody was going back to the Galapagos in the 1860s after The Origin had been published, and he wrote a letter to this guy saying, collect data on the effect of introduced species. This is an important topic. And unfortunately, the person didn't go. But it's something we're now studying in the 20th century. And one of the ways I study it is by using a method called repeat photography. I've spent many years collecting old photographs that were taken in the Galapagos as long ago as 100 years ago. and I go back to these sites and get the camera in exactly the same spot. I've even gone to places and waited for the shadows to move into exactly the same position they were when the original photograph was taken. And often that makes a real difference in what you see in the photograph. And through comparison of photographs over time, you can see how dramatic the changes have been as a result of the introduction of things that don't belong in the Galapagos.
Wow. You know, that's a really, I like that method, actually. I was looking at a book, just a coffee table book that my father had that was about fires in the Sierra Nevada. But they had photographic, it was that repeat photography. They'd take pictures in the exact same places now versus, Yosemite Valley, the oldest picture they could find, go back and take a picture in the exact same spot and show the difference in the forest and things like that. It was sort of analyzing how our management of the forest has possibly contributed to some of the problems, but it was pretty, that's a fascinating method. So what, have you had any major surprises or breakthroughs in the research as a result of that?
Well, nothing terribly novel or earth-shaking, but I did find, and I published an article about a year and a half ago, I found a photograph taken in 1970 by a Japanese botanist near the summit of an island called Santiago. And this is an island that Darwin visited in 1835, and he camped on that island for 10 days. And it turns out this photograph was taken at just about the last point that Darwin reached as he walked from the coast to the summit of the island. So he stood just about where this photograph was taken and looked down into a kind of a bowl-shaped area that was part of a kind of a deformed caldera. And in this photograph, and Darwin describes the luscious vegetation at that time, the summit of the island was very heavily vegetated. In this photograph, about half the vegetation was gone. And if you enlarged the photograph, you could see in the photograph half a dozen feral goats, a donkey, and several feral pigs all munching away at the vegetation in this photograph. And I went back and found exactly where that photograph was taken. It took me 3 or 4 years to identify where the photograph was taken. It could have been anywhere on that island. And I finally found the spot, and I took a new photograph, and all the vegetation was gone. It's like a football field. It's just grass. And
oh, wow.
The feral goats had finished off, and the donkeys had finished off all the trees. Literally, they eat trees. They just eat through the bark and kill the trees, and then finally the seed source is gone, and they eat all the seedlings, and boom, there's no more trees. The National Park in the Galapagos did a sort of a heroic effort to get rid of the both the feral pigs and the goats on that island, as well as the donkeys. And they spent about 15 years hunting the feral pigs by foot with trained dogs that had to have their feet bound with little booties to protect against the harsh lava landscape. And then eventually, once they'd gotten rid of the feral pigs, they went after the goats with helicopter gunships that they had from New Zealand with trained sharpshooters. And they eliminated over 100,000 goats from that island. And at the time they succeeded, that was the largest landmass on Earth from which a quadruped had ever successfully been eliminated.
Wow.
And of course, now that vegetation is coming back, and so if I can, go back to that spot where I took that photograph in 10 or 15 years, we may see a return of the vegetation that Darwin saw in 1835.
For the first time.
I just thought that was a wonderful thing, to find a spot that Darwin would have seen and then watch it transform over time.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's fascinating, and I had 100,000, wow. That's quite an undertaking.
A lot of goats.
Amazing. That is a lot of goats. Yeah, goats are very...
Goats are actually more water tolerant than camels. They're extraordinary animals. They can get by with no water at all, get all their water from vegetation. And they've also been observed to drink seawater. They're able actually to process salt water under dire conditions, which, no human could do. If you drank salt water and you were dehydrated, that would kill you.
Wow. fascinating. I did not know that. Very good. How are we for time? I know we didn't have a huge commitment of time tonight, and I want to be sensitive to your time.
Oh, I'm fine. Yep.
You're good? All right.
Yep.
Well, maybe let's talk a little bit about your books, because we are winding down the hour. So tell me a little bit about the books that you've written and who they might interest and what they're about.
Well, my first book was called Freud, Biologist of the Mind, Beyond the Psychoanalytic Legend. It was published in 1979. It was an academic bestseller in its day. It was Time magazine actually did a news story on the book when it came out. The basic gist of the book was that Freud, who many people don't realize, was trained as a biologist and spent the first 40 years of his life as a neurophysiologist, developed or invented psychoanalysis by drawing on all these biological ideas that he had imbued as a young medical student. And they influenced psychoanalysis in very crucial ways that hadn't been fully understood. And one of the unfortunate aspects of Freud's theoretical structure is that the biology on which he drew is now known to be completely wrong. It involved two sets of sort of interrelated ideas that have been tossed out by modern science. One was based on Helmholtz's principle of the conservation of energy. So Freud really believed that there was a conservation of mental energy. So if you had some mental cathexis of some idea and you didn't express it as you should, say a sexual idea, that energy will go somewhere else in your mind, and because it's conserved. And often he theorized that it would do things like cause paralysis. Hysterical paralysis. Well, we now know that there's no such thing as conservation of mental energy in the mind. The mind has its own internal energy sources. It turns on, it turns off. Neurons are generating energy all the time. This notion of a hydraulic system in which energy flows back and forth the way water would flow through a set of pipes was just a wrong way to think about the mind. And unfortunately, that affected a lot of Freud's conclusions. The second mistake that Freud made was, although he was very much an evolutionist, he was a Lamarckian evolutionist. He believed in the inheritance of acquired characteristics. And you need to believe in the inheritance of acquired characteristics in order to believe in something that was called the biogenetic law. This was an idea that was set forth by one of Darwin's greatest supporters, a man named Ernst Haeckel in Germany. According to the biogenetic law, the child, as they develop, is recapitulating the adult stages of our ancestors. And all species, according to the biogenetic law, are repeating the adult stages of their ancestors. Now, this is one reason in Freudian theory why children go through an oral, an anal, and a phallic stage. That this whole notion makes no sense unless you believe in the biogenetic law. So the very first stage of the evolution of sexuality in single-celled organisms was the invagination of that single-cell organism or the small multicellular organism to form an oral orifice. And then these little creatures, sort of like the Pac-Man game, they went around gobbling up other creatures, gobbling up their DNA or whatever. And so the first form of sex was oral. It was cannibalism. And that's why the child goes through that first stage in Freud's mind. That's why the oral stage is first instead of last. It's because it was the first evolutionary stage. And then there's eventually an evolution of sort of a primitive sexual system associated with a cloaca, as in, say, crocodiles. That's the anal stage. And then finally you get the evolution of genitalia. And so Freud essentially believed the child has to go through those stages owing to the fact that it must repeat the biogenetic law. Well, unfortunately, Lamarckian inheritance is not true. We Mendelian genetics threw that out the window. And so there's no inherited memories, as Freud believed, and no sort of inherited recapitulations of stages. None of that is true. And so the book that I wrote was a sort of a radical reanalysis and reassessment of psychoanalysis based on all these cryptic assumptions that Freud carried over into theory. And I basically concluded that the theory, although it's a fascinating theory, was basically wrong.
Wow. So how has there has a pardon the pun, but has the psychoanalysis, I don't know what you call that industry, has it evolved as a result of this recognition? And I mean, I understand it's just a part of, but it's a pretty big part of the way that I'm assuming it plays a very big role in how modern, psychology is operated, functions.
Well, psychoanalysis used to have a major influence in psychiatry back in the 1950s, 1960s, and that influence began to wane in the 1970s when I published my book. And psychoanalysis today is really a much more marginal enterprise, given the role that the emerging brain sciences have had in getting us to understand what really goes on in the mind. So all sorts of things that we still sort of accepted in the 60s or 70s, like Freud's theory of dreaming, no longer have any scientific validity now that we can actually go in and measure what happens when neurons turn on and turn off and we actually sleep and dream and so forth. So the stock of psychoanalysis has plummeted considerably, and not just for the reasons that I have mentioned. There are other methodological issues involved as well in the sort of demise of psychoanalysis. Unlike Darwin, his stock has kept going up. So.
Exactly. So where did you go from there? So what was your next venture?
Well, I actually had turned to Freud in order to understand Darwin. I thought, gee, if you're going to if conversion to a radical revolution involves certain psychological influences, you could do worse than to read a little Freud, who I hadn't read. Actually, I'm not sure I could have done worse, but I ended up writing a book that in some ways made a name for myself as an historian of science. And then I went back to working on Darwin and wrote a whole series of articles on his intellectual development, and particularly the story about how he did not become an evolutionist in the Galapagos that I mentioned at the outset of our conversation, that it got me interested in birth order. So I spent quite a bit of time in the 1980s writing about Darwin, and particularly about the legend of Darwin's finches. In a lot of the textbooks, it was thought that the finches were what converted Darwin to evolution, and that was, in fact, the last thing that really occurred. Darwin was so fooled by Darwin's finches when he was in the Galapagos that he mistook them for the forms that they appear to resemble through a phenomenon called convergent evolution. So, for example, the finches evolved so far from each other by this process of diversification, just like siblings diversifying, that some of the finches don't look like finches any longer. Mm-hmm. And when Darwin collected them and wrote up his notes in his notebook, he listed these birds as non-finches. So he thought the warbler finch, for example, was a warbler. And he thought that the cactus finch, which has a long pointed bill, was what he classified as an Icteridae, which is a family of birds that has a long pointed bill. So it was only when he got back to England that a man named John Gould, a very famous 19th century ornithologist, sat Darwin down and said, these birds are not, warblers and Icteridae. These are all finches, and these birds are going to make you famous. And what's interesting about that whole story is that Darwin, who knew less than Gould, saw more than Gould did. Gould never became an evolutionist. But once Darwin got the details right, he saw the big picture. That's a very interesting feature about him. And secondly, you can't expect Darwin, he was a young man when he went on the Voyage of the Beagle, and he was collecting in botany and mammalogy and ornithology. You can't expect him to know every possible nuance of classification. This is stuff done by experts. You bring your specimen back to a country and a big museum, and the expert in birds looks at your birds, and it may even be an expert in South American birds, and mm-hmm. does the classification. So Darwin couldn't have done that all by himself on the Beagle voyage. He needed somebody like Gould and other experts who helped him. So it's interesting, when Darwin finally did get that kind of expertise, boom, he got the big picture, and that's why we remember who Darwin was, and most people have never heard of John Gould. That I found that very intriguing. That it really just shows you there's such magic that goes on with creative achievement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see it's the discoveries that you've had over the years, it must have been extremely exciting for you and really invigorating. And I could understand why you published all the papers, because as you're discovering these all these nuances and interesting facts, to share them with people is a joy.
Well, it's certainly been a lot of fun. I'll have to say that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's certainly been. We're just about done with an hour here. It's certainly been fun learning from you and getting even more of the story and more of the science around this topic. It's a fascinating topic to me. I've already sort of tipped my hand on my birth order. I was, I guess if I hadn't, I could ask you at this point what you thought I was. But since I've already tipped my hand, it's not really fair to ask. But
well, I'll make a prediction nonetheless.
Okay.
Since I know you're a younger sibling, I'll predict you are one.
There
that?
You go. Hey, good job. Well done. well, there's your. You already have the data point, but hey, you're 100% correct. So.
It also shows how much I learned from Freud. He did that kind of stuff all the time.
well, I have to say it's been a great pleasure to speak with you, Dr. Soloway, and I want to thank you for taking the time to discuss this topic. And just judging by your enthusiasm about it, I'm sure it was an enjoyable experience for you as well.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And everyone, this has been Joe Hackman with Dr. Frank Soloway, and my Blog Talk Radio program is at blogtalkradio.com/Joe Hackman. I'm also HackmanJ on Twitter, and I want to thank you for listening. Frank, how can folks get in touch with you if they have questions about your research or would like to learn more?
Well, I have a website that has all my publications on it and a lot of information about my research, and it's Soloway.org, so Soloway.org. If you type that in on Google, it'll take you right to my website.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Have a great evening.
Thank you.
Take care.